morning comes from the Epistle of James. And I'm going to be reading from the third chapter, verses 1 through 10. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For all of us make many mistakes. Anyone who makes no mistakes is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large, it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, is itself set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species, but no one can tame the tongue. A restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessings and curses. My brothers and sisters, this ought not to be so. The Lord always blesses the people of God, the word of God, and the people of God say, thanks be to God. I did not print the title of my sermon anywhere because almost none of you would have showed up to listen to it. The title of my sermon today is, We Need to Argue More. Pick your subject. We need to argue more. Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Mitch McConnell, LGBTQ, we need to argue more. The United Methodist denomination, we need to argue more. The last quarrel you had with your spouse that didn't get settled, you need to argue more. So allow me to argue why we need to argue more. I had the privilege last Thursday to sit at the table with Judge Barnes, and my first opportunity to get acquainted with him. He spent many years in his courtroom having to make decisions about people's lives, and the only way he could make those decisions is if people entered his courtroom and made good arguments. How could he have made any wise decisions if people had not prepared good arguments on both sides for him? He depended on arguments to be able to administer justice. Now, I haven't read any of his decisions. I'm just now getting to know him. But my guess is that many of his decisions did not please one side or the other 100%. My guess is that after he heard arguments, that he found some sort of a synthesis between the two arguments in order to be able to do justice and to hand down a wise decision. Am I right on that? All right. I thought I was. So, argument is important if we are to proceed wisely. An argument is when we put it out on the table. Our thoughts, our reasoning, our experience, our stories, our feelings. We put it out there and then we prepare to defend it. On the other hand, an argument also involves listening to other people. Put their experiences, their thoughts, their logic, their feelings on the table. And we challenge them. And the purpose of an argument is to find the truth and to find a common way forward. Now, going back to Judge Barnes' courtroom, the next time I have an opportunity to have lunch with him or sit down, I want to hear about those times that he slapped someone with contempt of court. And he would have done that not because they made an argument, because they went from arguing to quarreling. Arguing is a necessity in the courtroom. It's a necessity in a marriage. It's a necessity in a church. Among those of us who have a variety of experiences, insights, and understandings. But quarreling is of the devil. When we argue, we follow the rules of argument. We follow the rules of logic. We follow the rules of empathy. We follow the rules of curiosity, of humility. We follow the rules of listening to one another. We follow the rules of remembering that we don't know everything, and we need people who think differently from us, or how could two heads be better than one? And so arguing is a necessity, but quarreling is a disaster. And I've got to tell you, I haven't heard a good argument in the church for ages. All I've heard is quarreling. All I've ever heard for ages is people who agree with each other, whether they really agree with each other or not. All I've seen in the church is people who cower, who don't want any part of a conversation where we have differences of opinion. And so that's why the title of my sermon this morning is We Need More Arguing. We need no more quarreling. No more. Because when we quarrel, all we are doing is we have determined that we're going to win. Even if we have to break the rules of logic, even if we have to break the rules of empathy, even if we have to ignore the truth, we're going to win. That's what quarreling does. Quarreling breaks all the rules that are so necessary. Now, you probably want to know where I get that from the Bible. If you want to argue with me, you say, okay, that makes logical sense. But where does it come from the Bible? Well, I'm going to digress a moment, and I want to talk about a little church that existed 50, 60 years ago down in Dalton City, Illinois, which is south of Decatur. I was 9 years old when my dad got sent to that church. Dalton City had about 400 people in it at that time, and I asked my dad when I was about 9 years old if I could go to Wednesday night prayer meeting with him. I have no idea what caused me to ask him that, because I was the only kid there. It was a group of about a dozen or so people. It would, you know, go up and down, but it was about a dozen or so people. My dad was probably, well, he would have been in his 30s, and everybody else, I'm pretty sure, was over 100 years old, from what I can remember. And we would get together, and the first thing they always did was Mrs. Walker always played the piano. She did not play, let me put it this way, you would not mistake Mrs. Walker's playing with Lynn's playing, so. But Mrs. Walker always played the piano, and people called out their hymns that they wanted to sing, And inevitably, every week, the same person would pick the same hymn that they wanted to sing. We always sang, "What a Friend We Had, What a Friend We Have in Jesus." We always sang, "Trust and Obey." We always sang, "He Hideth My Life in the Rock." I get up here and I can't remember. Pardon? "He Hideth My Life. He Hideth My Soul in the Cleft of the Rock." Right. We always sang that one. That was Mrs. Walker's favorite. And so we everybody got to pick which hymn they want. And then they prayed. And about a half a dozen of them would pray. And they prayed, even though they prayed from the heart, and even though they prayed, you know, extemporaneously, I noticed it was the exact same prayer every week that each person had. That people fall into a pattern in terms of how they pray. Occasionally the names would be changed. And then they would all open the book of John. After they were done with their prayers, they would open the book, the Gospel of John, and they would argue. Somebody would read a verse, and they would argue about it. I went there for 2 full years. We never even made it through a chapter of John. And they would argue about what the words meant. They would argue about how you apply the words. They would argue about whether you took something literally or figuratively. They would just argue about this. And that's how they loved each other. That's how they tested each other. That's how they worked things out. And I'm sure looking back, there were probably some quarrelsome people there as well. I can't doubt that. But the thing I notice is they wrestled with each other about what this precious living book meant. And that's the way they loved each other. Now, they never argued with me at first because I didn't understand what they were talking about. I was 9. And the Gospel of John is, I think, one of the 2 or 3 most difficult books of the Bible to try to understand. It is with all of the different literary and mysterious things going on in John. So I didn't argue with them, but they loved me enough that when they found out I was a Cub fan, they went for me at that point. They were all Cardinal fans back in that town. So they argued with me. They found a way to argue with me too. And so I remember it was around that time that I went to a revival. And when the altar call came, an old man stood up and led the congregation in "Fill Me Now." And my heart was touched. And I went forward and I knelt at the altar rail and I gave my life to Christ. And I remember going home that night thinking, okay, I've made a very profound decision. I was lying in my bed that night. I had my own bedroom at that time. And I was trying to figure out what all this meant, that I had given my life to Christ. And I thought, does this mean that I have to have positions on all those arguments? Does this mean I have to know everything of what every word and every verse means now in the Gospel of John? Does this mean I have to be able to eloquently declare whether baptism should be by sprinkling or by dunking? Does this mean now that I'm a Christian, I have to have all this information and I have to find the right thing now in the right place to settle down? And it was just one of those strange things. I remember it as though it were last night. A voice spoke to me, not a voice that I could hear, but a voice that nevertheless imprinted the words on my mind and heart. And the words that were imprinted were, "You don't need to worry about any of that right now. You're 9. The only thing you need to worry about at this point is that you love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind, and that you love your neighbor as yourself." And suddenly I felt at peace, because as long as I stayed in the heart of what Jesus taught, the rest of this stuff could come and go. And the fact is, as I've tried to understand these things through the years, all these complications and all these differences of opinions, I have from time to time changed my own mind. And the only thing I've ever felt was demanded of me by God is that I love God with all my heart, soul, strength, and mind, and that I love my neighbor as myself. That hasn't wavered since I was 9 years old. Not to say that I've always gotten it right, but I've always come home to that. Through all of the confusions and through all of the debates and through all of the arguments and through all the quarrels that I've heard in the church through the years. Now, the other thing that stuck with me in that experience was that I needed to never put my Bible down. That was the other thing that seemed to be clear to me that night that I gave my life to Christ, was that I had to read and read and read and understand and go deeper and deeper into the scriptures. And as I got older and as I entered the ministry, one of the things that I realized was that the Bible was one of the most important ways that I had to love God with my heart, my mind, my strength, and my soul. And I also realized, particularly through all the years of my ministry, how much I was able to love people that God gave me because I could share with them a story, or I could share with them a verse, or I could share with them some insight that came from the Bible. So early on, I determined that I was going to be a Bible scholar. I was going to learn Greek. I was going to learn Hebrew. I was going to read everything that I could about the Bible. And so the Bible has been my book. And the more I have read in the Bible, the more I have discovered that the Bible is one argument after another. People are different. Moses is different from Abraham. Abraham is different from God. Paul is different from the Christians that were in the churches that he organized and that he served. Peter is different from Philip, who's different from Andrew, who's different from John. And when I read the Bible, I realized that Jesus spent a great deal of time arguing with people. Now, there were those who wanted to quarrel with him, scribes and Sadducees and Pharisees. They were trying to pick a quarrel, but Jesus always turned it back to an argument. He listened to them. He understood what was important to them. And he always found a way, whenever they tried to pick a quarrel, he always found a way to argue back in a way that could somehow set up the opportunity that they could find the truth and they could find common ground. Everything that Paul wrote was an argument. Every single one of his letters is a sustained argument. He's putting it out there. He's putting out his insights, his understanding of Scripture, his feelings that he's having, his experience of Christ in his life. And every one of his letters is in the literary form of an argument that he has there. And when he was training younger pastors such as Timothy and Titus, let me share with you, because he was very adamant that when they were going to do their work with people, Timothy, you remember, was kind of young and kind of timid. And Paul was saying, no, you got to speak up. You cannot let your youth intimidate you from saying the things that you have to say. And so he wrote to Timothy. He said, from childhood, you have known the sacred writings that are able to instruct you for salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. All scripture is inspired by God and is useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, so that the people of God might be equipped for every good work. Proclaim the message, Paul writes to Timothy, and be persistent whether the time is favorable or unfavorable. Convince, rebuke, and encourage with the utmost patience and teaching. That's the definition of what it means to argue. He writes to Titus, reminding Titus to not quarrel. Titus also is to put it out there, what he has to say to people. To speak, but to remember this, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, and to show courtesy to everyone. So Paul distinguishes between putting it out there, what we have to say, and what it means to quarrel, which is the work of the devil. Now it's interesting in the Old Testament that when God was forming his chosen people, he named them Israel. And the word Israel in Hebrew means those who wrestle and argue with God. That's the literal meaning of Israel. El is God. Isra means to argue and wrestle. And that always fascinated me because I thought, well, that what's God up to here? Because that's a whole different understanding than sometimes we're taught in the church, where many of our images of God come from hierarchical understandings of people in the church trying to maintain power. And so the more I began to look into that, of course, that name came on the night that Jacob himself wrestled with God. And it was interesting to me that there's a difference between wrestling and boxing. Boxing is like quarreling. The thing you're trying to do in boxing, you're just trying to knock out your opponent's teeth and beat out their brains. That's boxing. And kind of makes me think of quarreling. All we're trying to do is somebody who disagrees with us, knock out their teeth and beat out their brains. And wrestling is different. Wrestling, you know, when you wrestle somebody, you grab their hands. You have them by the hand. And you go chest to chest and belt, gut to gut and leg to leg, heart to heart. You learn things about the person whom you're wrestling. You learn where the twists and the turns are and the strengths and the weaknesses. You smell their breath. You feel their sweat. And you go ear to ear. And that's the way God wants a relationship with us. It's interesting. Why did the 12 tribes of Israel not come from Abraham? Why did the 12 tribes of Israel not come from the loins directly of Isaac? Why did they come? Why did the 12 tribes of Israel come directly from the line, from the loins of Jacob? And when we read in the book of Genesis, Abraham had two children. One was free and one was slave. We can't be the people of God if we're slaves. We have to be free. And Isaac had no capacity to argue. Isaac just sort of went along with everybody. Think of his son, Esau, who got duped all the time. Isaac couldn't argue. Couldn't think for himself. His wife thought for him, or his sons thought for him. And so the 12 tribes do not come from the loins of Isaac. They come from the loins of Jacob, who argued with everybody to the point that he was a pain. But it was in that arguing, God saw in that, this is where people become fully human. This is where people engage each other. This is where people are going to engage me. And so Israel, the ones who would wrestle, argue, engage God. And it's in the wrestling that we grow. It's in the wrestling that we hear the voice of the living God helping us to know what to do. And so arguing is critical. If we are to work our way through the difficulties that we face in a marriage, in a family, in a church, in a nation. Now, I want to say one more thing this morning about the subject of tribalism, because tribalism is a quarrel occurring on a massive scale. Tribalism occurs when we believe that there's a group of people out there that are so ignorant, that are so misled, that are so dangerous, that are so evil, that if we don't stop them, they're going to destroy everything that matters to us. I'll say that again. Tribalism is when we become convinced that there is a group of people out there so misled, so ignorant, so dangerous, so evil, that if we don't stop them, they're going to destroy everything that matters to us. And one of the things that we've seen happening, and it didn't used to happen in the earlier days or even in the middle of my ministry, it's only happened as I approached retirement and have been retired, is we are seeing massive tribalism in our nation and in our churches. People choosing up sides, determined that those who disagree with them are a danger to what matters to us. And the thing that's interesting about tribalism, it's a form of quarrel. We lose our empathy. We lose our logic. If we feel that somebody's a danger to us, we don't even care about the truth anymore. We just care about stopping them. Now, we're seeing this creep as this is really our politics today, and it is poisoning our churches, it's poisoning our friendships, it's poisoning our families. There are people and families who can't even talk to each other anymore because of the tribalism that we have today in our country. Now, when I went to Salem about a year and a half ago, I was sent there as an interim minister, and I have opinions. I have opinions about the church. I have opinions about political matters. I have strong opinions about all of these things. So I went down there to Salem, and I drove to the parsonage the first night I stayed in the parsonage. I drove into the parsonage, and this was, of course, in the middle of the election of 2020. So I drove into the parsonage, and here the neighbors right next door to me had this big political sign in their yard with the blaring out the name of the candidate I was not going to vote for. And the first thing I noticed is it made me tense. I saw that sign and I saw this was going to be my neighbor, and it made me tense. It made me sort of clam up. It upset me. And I thought, I'm going to have to see that doggone thing every time I come to my house now, because that's out there in their yard. And I thought, well, at least they're not members of my church, I thought. And it turned out they're members of my church. So I got to the church, and the secretary was telling me about some family in a church, and she says, oh yeah, they live right next to you. So I thought, I hope they live to the north of me and not the south. But they live to the south of me. It was their sign. And so you see, that threw me into a crisis, because I do have strong feelings about issues. But yet I was there to be their pastor. I was not there to campaign for the 2020 election. I was sent to Salem to be the pastor of everybody in that church, everybody, and everybody in that town who would be open to me. Well, it wasn't too long. It was a few weeks, and the couple with the sign in their driveway invited me over to dinner. And I thought, all right, they're probably not going to poison me because they don't know which side I'm on. So I thought, it's probably safe. So I went over there and had dinner. And you know, they turned out to be two of the most loving, wonderful people that I have had ever in my churches. I've had plenty of loving, wonderful people, and that's who they were. And they were so gracious, and they were so kind, and they were so loving, and we became friends. And then, after the election was over, we had a workshop. In fact, it was a friendship workshop that they came to that I'm going to offer here a few times while I'm here. And at the break, the woman came up to me and she said, you know, we've had a really hard time keeping our friends through this election. She says, we've just had to not even talk to them because people are so upset. And she said, you know, people were even stealing the sign out of our yard. And I thought, oh my gosh, I was tempted to do that. So I'm glad I didn't get caught. I didn't do it. I thought, I'm glad I didn't get caught even thinking that. And I said to her, I said, you and your husband have taught me a lesson. I said, you know, I didn't vote the same way you did. I saw the sign in your yard. I said, I didn't vote the same way you did. And she says, you didn't. I said, no. I said, but I was so caught up in the tribalism, in thinking that people who disagreed with me were so misled, so ill-informed, so dangerous, that it was so urgent that I draw the line and not listen, not be affected, not allow, you know, do everything I could to try to be sure that we could save what mattered to us, to me. And I said, and then you and your husband came along, and I said, I was struggling with what it meant to be a pastor in this church, and you and your husband loved me through that. A couple months later, I picked up a book by a French brain scientist by the name of René Levy, and he was writing about tribalism. He said, here's what happens in the human brain. First of all, we get afraid. And when we get afraid of somebody, then we circle the wagons. We only talk to people who agree with us. And we circle the wagons. And this scientist said that the brain actually starts to function differently when we get afraid of a group of people. That what we do is the section of the brain that can do logic completely gets walled off, so that we only hear what supports our fears. And the other thing that happens is the section of the brain that allows us to be empathetic is also starved whenever the fear of tribalism takes over in our minds, so that we become physiologically incapable of either logic or empathy once we've drawn up sides and once we've started quarreling. And I thought, my adventure in Salem during election year was really God putting me to the test to see whether I would discover that verse in 1 John 4:18 that perfect love casts out all fear. And my challenge was, in spite of everything going on in the nation, in spite of everything going on in the church, my challenge was to find that gift that God had given me. The reason we're able to love is because God loves us first. And because I had the gift of my neighbors that God had given me to help me understand that this was the only way forward. Now, I do think that we have a lot of issues. We're facing unprecedented challenges as mainline churches decline, as we face the COVID, as we face increasing tribalism in our nation. If there was ever a time when God needed his people to have love casting out fear, if there was ever a time when God needed his people to be able to argue with empathy, with wisdom, to find common ground, to learn from each other. There's no one of us that's smart enough to make it through all the challenges that our churches, that our lives are facing today. I am convinced that the only healing for our nation will be able to come from our churches as we learn to set aside all quarreling, all tribalism, to love people who differ from us, and to learn how to talk with each other again in a spirit of respect and curiosity and humility. The Civil War started in this nation because the churches couldn't stop quarreling among themselves. And the nation was lost because the church people were infected with the disease of quarreling. And the only way that we can face a future where we do have to live together, we do have to think together, we do have to find common ground together, the only way we're going to be able to do that is if we open our hearts up to the love of God and make sure that nothing ever, ever stands in the way of our ability to be empathetic, to listen, and to learn from one another. I just don't think there have been enough arguments in the church. Nothing but quarrels. Nothing but people who superficially agree. Nothing but people who cringe in a corner because they're afraid to speak up about anything. It's time to trust God, to trust each other. It's time to lean into our love and start talking in every arena of our lives. I'm going to ask Lynn to play a little music for us and invite you to a period of meditation and to commitment.